This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The Takeaway, your guilty pleasure each day, right? We contribute to your sloth, or you envy our guests, maybe, or maybe you down a pint of ice cream while you listen to the program in the most gluttonous way. You can confess to us, even though there's not much we can do to absolve you.
Jeffrey Davis, North Carolina. When was the last time I sinned? I would have to say maybe 5 minutes ago. I have a habit of cussing.
Ooh, Jeffrey, you need to work on that. We're working on the seven deadly sins this hour, the subject of a new Showtime series directed by Morgan Spurlock. Spurlock on gluttony. Now that will be rich, don't you think? Confess at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Also, more on Africa this hour, a contrary look at the Washington summit. But our focus at the top of the hour is justice for sale.
The most liberal place in Tennessee, it's not a college campus. It's not a big city. It's here, the state Supreme Court. Liberal Democrats control our court and threaten your freedom.
Today, voters in Tennessee decide whether to keep judges on the state Supreme Court. Campaign ad money has made the judicial race in Tennessee a hot political contest this year. Judges appointed by a Democratic governor face well-funded conservatives determined to see them replaced. And conservatives are also on the hunt for judges in North Carolina, Michigan, Montana, New Mexico, Ohio, and Texas. We'll hear in a moment from a judge in Iowa who is a casualty of the campaign money and all this politicization. But let's start with the national picture from partner station WGBH, where Bert Brandenburg, executive director of Justice at Stake, joins us. Welcome, Bert.
Nice to be here.
So if you're running a political action committee, what's your mission if you want to either hold on to particular judges or change the face of a court in a certain state around the country?
Well, it's interesting because Supreme Court races in the states have not traditionally been playing fields for PACs and other political interests until the last decade or so. There's still a feeling that you can buy a court for a lot less than you can buy a legislature. And then you go in and you use the very same tactics you use elsewhere. You try to flood the place with money. And in the case of judicial elections, you, of course, are taking a system of courts that's supposed to be different from the other branches of government and starting to turn it on its head. You're turning the judges into fundraisers. And so we've now seen over the last decade a doubling amount of the amount of money going into judicial elections. And you now have a system where a lot of judges feel trapped in a system they didn't sign up for. They're forced to become professional fundraisers. And a lot of the public is worried that justice is for sale.
And on one level, this would make the judiciary less separate from the legislative branch because there would be more partisanship, right?
This is one of the gravest risks. We elect our legislators and our executives to make promises and keep promises. That is politics. We give our judges a different assignment. The Constitution tells our judges, you're supposed to decide cases one at a time based on the facts and the law, not based on political pressure, not based on campaign ads, not based on campaign money you may have raised. And even more chilling is that the judges who are now trapped in the system, when they go out to raise the money, the people they go to are the parties who then appear before them. In North Carolina, a Supreme Court justice this year told the media that she was having to spend more of her time in the evenings and mornings writing her opinions because she has to spend more of her daytime going around to law firms and dialing up attorneys for money. And these are the attorneys who then appear before her in court.
Now, is there also a sense that there are marching orders from the political action committees or from the use of money in these campaigns in the sense that you are a judge that we understand is going to rule this way on same-sex marriage or this way on voter registration restrictions or this way on certain laws that have, very strong partisan identifications within states?
Well, money tends to speak for itself. And part of what's happening is as more races are targeted around the country, the word is out essentially to judges that if you've got a controversial case, you may have to look over your shoulder. So in Iowa a few years ago, when three justices were unseated because they were part of a unanimous decision on marriage there, you had justices in a couple of other states respond the following years by going out and becoming big fundraisers. That's not something they've had to do. They obviously keep an eye on it. And again, we want our judges to be insulated from politics, not keeping an eye on it.
If we wanted our judges to be insulated from politics, why ever have them be elected? Why did this tradition begin anywhere in any state?
You know, it's interesting. The U.S. is the only country in the world that elects any significant number of judges, and it came out of Jacksonian populism. The goal was to basically clean up government by giving more power to the people, and so the election of judges really became popular in the states at that point. And what happened was that it then became taken over by party interests and insiders. You then had the birth of what's called a merit selection retention system, where you have the judges who are appointed with the help of a screening committee on the front end to try to get quality judges on the bench. And then on the back end, they face what's called a retention election, where they stand by themselves without an opponent. And we now have a patchwork of systems around the United States. About 90% of our judges have to stand for some kind of election during their careers. That's 38 states that select their Supreme Courts through elections. And that's a mix of these retention races where you stand by yourselves or contested elections where you have an opponent.
Now, you know, the counterargument is that judges should represent community standards like juries, and that electing judges ensures that the judge will represent the community standards in a state and carry out decisions that are at least judicially comprehensible to the people of that state.
Well, of course, every state elects its governor, and when the governor has the power to be involved in the selection of judges, they are exercising the will of the people who elected them. And in the end, it gets back to an issue of accountability. Judges, of course, have to be accountable. Every actor in a democracy has to be. The question is, who are they going to be accountable to? Are we going to have a system that the Constitution tried to create where the judges are accountable to the law and the Constitution? Or instead, are they going to be accountable to partisan and political pressure? Because that's what politics is. It's not just some sort of abstract grouping together of the will of the people. It's what motivated actors and increasingly wealthy actors think should happen.
Is this also about redistricting in the sense that courts and states have a huge hand in maintaining congressional districts and maintaining those lines to ensure incumbency?
I think that's right. The stakes are about power, and it's about redistricting. It's about a lot of things that state courts do. State courts handle 98% of all litigation in the United States. They are the engines of justice in America. So what they do is hugely important, and they are essentially – state court elections are now the fishing hole that's been discovered. Before 2000, the amount of money going in was episodic. Now it's systematic.
And so the outcome in Tennessee, the takeaway there for national – political watchers would be what?
A couple of interesting trends there. Number one, Tennessee has now joined the club. They've now had a $1 million election. They're seeing outside groups like Americans for Prosperity come in. Number two, you have another state where judges are now being turned into fundraisers. The judges are working to keep up with their opponents. They're out there raising money from the people who appear before them. Number three, and you talked about power politics a minute ago, there's one interesting twist. In Tennessee, the Supreme Court actually appoints Tennessee's attorney general. And it's fairly widely known that part of the campaign to switch some of the justices on the court is a campaign then to get in a different attorney general who, of course, executes other policies in the state.
Bert Brandenburg is executive director of Justice at Stake, a nonpartisan group. He spoke with us from WGBH in Boston. Thanks, Bert.
Thank you.
So what does it feel like for a man of the robes on the high bench to be a casualty of one of these PAC-targeted judicial races? Justice David Baker was ousted from the Iowa Supreme Court bench back in 2010 after he ruled in favor of same-sex marriage. Justice Baker, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm not the judge here in this case, and you're not the attorney, but what is the impact on your judgeship to face political opposition in the way that you faced it in 2010?
According to some political watchers, we were hit by a perfect storm in 2010 where there was an anti-incumbent sentiment, a retention vote that was scheduled approximately a year after a very highly controversial decision, and $1 million that was primarily out-of-state money that outspent the supporters of the judges. And I know to some states that doesn't sound like a lot of money, but $1 million in Iowa goes a long way. I don't think this was a perfect storm. I think I see this as a climate change in the politicization of judicial elections.
So you make a decision, and all of a sudden there's a campaign mobilized to oust you and some of your colleagues. Some people would say, well, that's democracy working. You know, you didn't do what was the will of the people, and so things are going to change.
I understand that, but we are not, the courts are not a legislature. We are bound by the rule of law, and our duty is to interpret the Constitution and to make decisions. Nobody really complained about the reasoning of our decision. They were going purely on politics. And as I said, most of the money came from out of state, about 95% of it, frankly. And I don't think it was so much to oust us, but was to send a message to other judges around the country that if you go against us, we're coming after you.
What kind of conversations have you had with judges around the country, and what do you make of the situation in Tennessee today?
I have a problem with this. I mean, aside from this fundraising aspect, there's going to be the perception by those using the courts that the court system is not fair and impartial. I can tell you one example. I met with a judge at a conference, and he told me flat out, your decision was right, but I could have never voted that way because I would have lost my job. And I find that somewhat disconcerting.
And can you tell me what state that was in?
I'd prefer not to.
Is that right there, a corruption of the judiciary, that someone is not going to vote an opinion they believe to be right because they'll lose their job?
I believe so. That's an appropriate response for a legislator. It's an appropriate response for somebody in the executive branch. It is not an appropriate response for a judge.
If the legislature in Iowa had passed a law banning same-sex marriage that you felt was constitutional, you would have voted for that, right?
Yes. I'll be honest with you. When I went into that case, I had no idea how I would vote ultimately. But, I mean, we received 5,000 pages of briefs, and it was quite clear to me that there was only one decision, and frankly, everybody on the court agreed. It was a unanimous decision that it simply could not meet the standards under our Equal Protection Clause.
So the consequence in a healthy system would be the legislature would go back to the drawing board and come up with a law that does meet the Equal Protection Clause, and it would get tested and approved by the court. In this case, they're just saying, forget the legislature, we'll throw out the judge.
That's correct. That's correct. This was a purely political campaign against us. They had, robocalls. They did the whole thing, the bus tour. They even set up voting satellite sites in the churches so that people could vote after they'd heard the sermon.
You bitter?
No. I did what I believed was correct, and even looking back, I would not have changed my vote.
Justice David Baker is a former Iowa State Supreme Court justice. He spoke with us from Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City, Iowa. Thank you, Justice.
Thank you.
Our literary voice from Africa today has very little direct experience in his country. Ethiopian-born author Dinau Mengistu has spent most of his life in America. His personal journey to understand and embrace his roots in Addis Ababa and to reconcile them with his upbringing in Peoria, Illinois, is part of the U.S.-Africa connection being discussed at the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit this week. Dinau Mengistu says Africans like him in the diaspora yearn to see other images of their home in America's consciousness, and he worries that the U.S. is still stuck in the famine days of the Cold War decades ago.
You know, I tend to think that our dominant image of Ethiopia is still a holdover from the 1980s. We still tend to imagine it, not just Ethiopia, but large parts of the continent as a sort of vast landscape plagued by poverty and by war. And in fact, Ethiopia is, a fairly rapidly developing country right now, fairly stable, not necessarily democratic government, but a rapidly developing one.
And would you say that as you grew up, as Ethiopia kind of broke into the consciousness of Americans, was it exclusively about famine and politics?
Oh, entirely. I mean, it wasn't even – the politics actually receded completely into the background. There's very little sense that – you had to understand the politics in order to understand the logic of the famine. It was just purely a very sort of sentimental idea of Ethiopia as a landscape of very poor, impoverished people that needed to be saved by the West. And that became the sort of dominant narrative of what Ethiopia's relationship to America was.
All Our Names is the title of your novel. And it's very much about this struggle to know your home and to also find a home in this place of your diaspora. How successful have you been in your life, and how challenging was this story to really keep a foot in both worlds?
I think personally I've been very fortunate. For me, writing's become a way of sort of forging my identity and forging an identity that's located as much in Africa as it is in the United States. You know, part of the problems I faced growing up was that there weren't really many narratives that looked like mine. There were very few African migrants in America, so it was difficult to understand exactly where you fit in. And writing's become a way for me to kind of straddle both landscapes, to say, well, I'm completely Ethiopian and I'm also completely American at the same time. And the books that I've tried to write since then, I think, are a reflection of that. They try to merge these two seemingly disparate stories and say, well, here, if you lay them together side by side, you can understand not only the individual lives that are affected by these countries and the politics within them, but also you can understand how these stories are incredibly similar to ours here in America.
And when Americans encounter you, I mean, do you have to do a sort of primer? I'm not Mandela. Yeah. I don't know Mandela. I'm not one of the Lost Boys, and you know that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's always,
really
well, not that I'm not one of the Lost Boys, but there is definitely this question of you know, they ask you your name, and they want to know where you're from, and there's an automatic attempt to hope that you have just a singular answer to that question. And for me, there is no singular answer. You know, where I'm from is as much a part of Peoria, Illinois, as it is Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Peoria.
Yeah,
everybody in Ethiopia knows what they make in Peoria, Illinois, I think, probably.
Of course.
Right? Of course.
We all make Caterpillar.
That's right. Yeah.
That's where my father worked when he first came to America.
The bulldozer.
Yeah, it was a very American trajectory.
Yeah.
It was sort of living the American dream, going straight from Africa to working for one of the most iconic American corporations in a very, very American landscape and town.
When I first went to the Horn of Africa, I was surprised to discover that Somalia and Ethiopia kind of switched sides, were traded during the Cold War. They're unique in that in the world, and it had devastating consequences for both countries.
Massively. And I mean, that tied in directly to what happened during the famine. You know, while the country was undergoing a civil war in the north, the Soviet Union kept arming the government, and that allowed the famine to sort of get progressively worse. Aid actually became a tool for the military to keep the war going. So unless you can kind of contextualize the politics, it's really hard to understand the poverty or to understand, you know, how Ethiopia played an important role in the Cold War alliances.
You know, one of the other myths about America's relationship with Africa is that it seems to be in the U.S. that this is something associated with democratic institutions. But if you go to Africa, there's a huge amount of gratitude to George W. Bush for some of the policies that he initiated in the first part of this century. Explain how you understand that.
You know, I think President Bush's investment in HIV programs was sort of enormously important, but I think we can't forget that a lot of that aid came with enormously devastating strings, you know, in terms of making sure that countries had abstinence-only programs rather than promoting the use of safe sex. And a lot of the legacies of that program, as we watch, you know, the money sort of dissipate, you can see now the sort of second wave of problems happening, where you have a sort of rise in homophobia in a lot of African countries. You have an increase in HIV in some places like Uganda, because people are now promoting abstinence rather than safe sex as a result of those programs. So I think it's important to remember that there are some really wonderful things that happen, but it's a very mixed legacy.
What would you raise your hand and say if you were at this summit in Washington, D.C.?
I would ask why the focus isn't on building institutions rather than developing trade and commerce. And I know those things can't always be separated, but it seems to me part of what this summit is doing is really trying to find a way to make American businesses have greater access to the sort of economic growth happening in Africa. And it seems that if you want that growth to happen responsibly and to happen over a really long period, the focus should be on how can we create strong institutions in these countries, not only in terms of democracy, but in terms of justice and law. And really then I think you begin to answer both the problems of economics and the human rights questions, which I think are being quietly put to the side in the summit.
Dina, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Dina Mengistu is an Ethiopian-American author, most recently of the novel All Our Names, which is the next pick for our Takeaway Book Club. Pick up a copy and read along with us. This month, the He-Man Book Lovers Club from Minnesota will help us break down the story of a man struggling with the pressures of identity in Africa and the U.S.
His father, when he was a boy, called him Bird because he liked living in the sky, flying above it all. And I think that's his chief characteristic. He He doesn't want to be consumed by politics. He wants to float free. But I do think that the author here is trying to test out a way of ordering your life, a way of being, where you're not defined by and consumed by tribe, religion, politics, and political events.
That's Finn Donetsky of the He-Man Book Lovers Club. The book is All Our Names by Dina Mengestu. Follow along at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
If a tree falls in a forest and no one heard it, did it make a sound? The answer, according to MIT graduate student in engineering Abe Davis, is yes. He says he knows this because of a new experiment that can recreate sound simply by extracting the motions sound make in the air and when they move objects around them, even if no one is listening. Here's a recording of Davis's team playing a very poor rendition of Mary Had a Little Lamb to a stationary houseplant in a soundproof room. Now, here is the same recording reconstructed from high-speed video analysis of that same houseplant, ever so slightly vibrating, decoding all the tiny motions. In the first case, the song comes from someone playing an instrument. In the second, it's based on just recreating sound from vibrations observed visually. The technology suggests that all our sounds someday might be recaptured, a video decoding mechanism that would allow someone to see exactly what we are saying, whether someone is listening or not. It's a brave new world, says Abe Davis.
I think that what me and my colleagues are really excited about right now is that here we've found that there's this signal that's in video that we didn't really realize was there. And now that we know it's there, there are a lot of questions to ask and there are a lot of things to look at. It sort of provides a new dimension to how we can image the world around us. And that's really exciting.
So the principle here is that everybody, every object is a kind of a microphone that takes the sound in the atmosphere around it. And by decoding the motions, can reconstruct the audio.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, all matter is going to respond at least somewhat to sound, right? Because you have these fluctuations in pressure, and then when they come into contact with an object, they're going to push on that object. But some objects are going to make better visual microphones than others. A lot of the initial experiments that we did were sort of in a very controlled setting where we put an object on top of an optical bench, and then we had a speaker sort of on a separate stand to the side that would play sound at the object. And then we would film it from a camera that was a few feet away and recording sort of very high-speed footage. And then once we started to sort of develop a picture of what the limitations were, then we started to try to figure out what are the more ambitious situations where we could try this. And probably the most ambitious situation that we've shown is this example where we recover speech from a bag of chips behind soundproof glass.
Well, let's listen to an example of this. First is a recording of a person reciting Mary Had a Little Lamb near a bag of potato chips.
Mary had a little lamb whose fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went, that lamb was sure to go.
Okay, now this is what you guys were able to recover from the high-speed video filming that bag of potato chips from outside behind soundproof glass.
Mary had a little lamb whose fleece was white as snow.
Let me do a kind of smiley face scenario of what you've developed here. That would be you can't afford the ticket to the concert, so you, you set your video up on the concert hall outside on the street and then it home and recreate the concert that you missed in a bootleg, right? That's conceivable maybe here.
Well, it's conceivable that that could work, but I suspect that if you can afford the amount of film that you would need and the processing power to make the technique work in that situation, at this point, then you could probably afford the concert ticket.
Okay, so let's do the sad face scenario here. The NSA wants to put some Abe Davis sensors on all of their webcams in downtown New York so that people standing near potato chip bags can have their conversations recorded as well as, you know, their faces.
I think that if you're concerned about general privacy, then this is not really a concern, because this technique is not the sort of thing that's going to be employed at a really wide scale and used on a lot of people. It's expensive, it's specialized. And really, when people hear about this, it's easy to imagine that you're just going to be able to pick up any sound from anywhere, you know, sort of that you'll be able to listen to anything that you can see now. But that's not really the case, right? And it's the same sort of situation that we have with regular cameras, where just because something is in your line of sight doesn't mean that you can get a good image of it, right? If it's far enough away, or if your lens isn't good enough, or if there's, you know, not good lighting in the room, there are all sorts of trade-offs that we have with photography. And the way that we're getting our signal here is really through photography. But what's really surprising here is just that it's possible at all.
You know, I'm just a nut, Abe, but you could, in theory, you could take the Zapruder film and figure out what Jackie was saying to JFK. Right? I mean, well, it's sort of there somewhere.
I'm hesitant to say, like, absolutely no without looking very closely at the signals. But I suspect that, you know, based on the numbers that we've estimated, that would be highly unlikely.
I'm glad you didn't say no. Wild to think about.
Yeah, it is. And in general, it's wild to think about how there are potentially a lot of videos that people have captured where some of this signal could be there. And for regular video, it's probably not going to be enough signal that you can actually recover intelligible speech. But it might be enough that you could pick up things like cadence and tone. And again, it also probably won't work for all of the videos that, you know, have been recorded. You know, for most of the videos that have been recorded, it's not going to work. But the fact that there are even some where this information was there and we didn't realize it is kind of exciting.
Abe Davis is a graduate student in electrical engineering and computer science at, of course, MIT. Thanks, Abe.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Takeaway, seven deadly sins. Can you name them? Can you name one? What about the last time you committed one? Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania gossiped yesterday. Well, that's not deadly.
This is Bill from Florida, and I think I'd rather give you the keys to my safe than reveal any of my sins out loud on the air.
All right, Bill, your secrets are safe with us. Miami, Florida says, this delectable barbecue plate of pork ribs and brisket I just devoured at Blue Willie's sure feels like a sin. That would be gluttony. Next up, documentary filmmaker Morgan Spurlock tells us about some people who take gluttony to a whole new level. His new series, Seven Deadly Sins, on Showtime. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. Confess your sins.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. Learn more at TiVo.com.
In the good old days of television, this was a big hit.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Alfred Hitchcock Hour. This is what I just pulled out of my hat.
Director Alfred Hitchcock on a creepy stage, introducing creepy little movies. It's the model for a very different show airing tonight on Showtime from documentary filmmaker Morgan Spurlock, who introduces us to some very creepy, gluttonous, and obese Americans.
That's the unique thing about being an American. They're never going to lose that weight. They're never going to lead a healthy, normal life. The food is so cheap relative to what we earn, there's no limit.
Spurlock's series, The Seven Deadly Sins, plants your face right into the center of people out of control. What he came up with for the episode on gluttony is pretty hard to take, but it's equally hard to turn away from shots of people eating burgers that are scarier than a scene from Psycho.
This is real. It's in downtown Las Vegas. If you go there,
You can go have a meal there. If you weigh if you weigh over 350 pounds, best part about this, if you weigh over 350 pounds, you get to eat for free.
Oh goody! Let's listen to Dr. Basso here.
Somebody has got to stand here and say, "Screw it! Wake up, world! You're fat." No, I'm not going to call you plus size. I'm not going to say you're portly. No, you're fat. Lose some weight. Or just hurry up and die and be done with it.
Now, he's an angry guy who had a legal problem with the name of his restaurant, which we won't go into, and yes, people can watch the episode.
That's right.
But the Heart Attack Grill, I mean, you can't imagine what this looks like.
And but
these
the name,
hamburgers are not
– yeah.
They're not architecturally sound. Let's just put it that way.
As you see in the film, and he describes, you know, during the show Seven Deadly Sins, kind of what the burgers are, and they have very apropos names. You know, there's the single bypass, which is a one burger with like five pieces of bacon cooked in like lard and butter fat, and that one single patty is 2,500 calories. There's the double bypass, which is 5,000 calories. Triple bypass, 7,000 plus calories, and then the quadruple bypass, which when it's standing tall is probably almost 10 inches tall of a burger and is 10,000 calories.
And what's the message here?
I mean, ultimately, when you watch the show and you watch all of these episodes, I think there's multiple messages that people will take away. One is, as you watch the show, you will see a little bit of you in different characters that were within the show. And, you know, there's the old adage, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. You know, you start to realize, who am I to judge these people and what they're doing? And, you know, ultimately, I think we all realize that the only thing we can control in this world is our own choices, our own decisions.
I'll tell you my impression of watching those people, and particularly the 350-pounders who were on the cattle scale.
Yeah.
And when it
and
weighs,
posing.
And when it registered over 350 and they get their meal for free, the whole restaurant cheers. End of the world crossed my mind.
Yeah. Yeah, you start to feel like that. Where are we going? Where is humanity going when you watch this show? And part of what I love about it is, you know, we live in a culture where we also snap to judgment of people. And as you get into other episodes, as you get into like lust and envy and the choices people make, you know, whether that be a guy who's in love with, you know, 90-year-old women and that's his thing, you know, a 30-year-old man who loves to date 80, 90-year-old ladies, who are we to judge? If that's what makes him happy and that's what makes these old lady happy. As he says in the show, he goes, listen, anybody who doesn't want their grandmother to be happy should feel terrible.
One way of looking at it. Yeah. All right. Well, since you brought up lust, there is a kind of a lust element in this episode, gluttony here. We meet darling Nikki.
Certain foods are orgasmic for me. When your stomach gets really, really, really tight and you feel like I'm at the point and then you continue to eat, it's just this out-of-body experience and it actually makes me aroused.
I can't believe that everyone hasn't already heard of Nikki, but she's quite large.
Yes, she's quite large. And the thing about Nikki is Nikki's original plan was she wanted to be the biggest woman in the world. And so originally she started eating her way to kind of breaking the Guinness Book of World Record. That's what she wanted to do.
I see. That's what she started.
And so once she hit about 600-700 pounds, she kind of went through a sexual transformation within her body where she felt better than she ever had. She felt kind of more in control, more empowered, more sexy than she ever had as a woman. And so she's like, there's something really wonderful happening right now. And I'm going to explore this and own this. And that's when she met her boyfriend, who there's a group of people, which some of your listeners may know, knowing your audience, that are called feeders. And so which are people who love to, during intercourse, feed their partner and watch them eat while enjoying one another's company.
You want to hear something really disturbing?
Yes.
I was watching this last night
with
my two 15-year-olds and my wife.
Yes.
And it's appropriate for that.
Yes.
The feeder stuff came on. I had no idea what it was. One of my 15-year-olds knew.
Explained it to you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Internet.
This is a really bad moment for me. But thanks, Morg.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah, I appreciate that a lot.
We're trying to educate the masses, and by masses I mean older people who don't know what feeders are.
Yeah. Now, the way you're describing this, it doesn't sound like gluttony is a sin. It sounds like gluttony is sort of an adventure.
I think we live in a culture where most of these sins are embraced as just being an American. You know, more than anything, I think that gluttony is part of our daily life in this country. You know, we're encouraged to overconsume whatever that may be, you know, food, et cetera. I think it's just part of this culture of consumption.
You know, finally, here in this episode on Showtime, you live up to the reputation and really mission of documentary filmmakers to teach people things. Mm-hmm. And here's something I did not know.
You have to cremate at a lower heat because the person's body fat can start a grease fire.
The amount of fat acts as a fuel. You get 17,000 BTUs of fuel per pound of fat. As they melt down and the fat starts to spread and liquefy, it could cause the machine to overflow and actually spill out onto the floor.
Now, this is a funeral director.
Yes.
Describing the implications of so many people being this big.
That's right. And back when I was making Super Size Me, I got so many letters from people all across the country, emails who were, you know, either had kind of terrible fast food experiences or different things. And I got contacted by a gentleman who worked in a mortuary who talked about how this exact thing had happened, that basically while burning a very obese person, the fat was burning off faster than they'd anticipated. And it started to kind of bubble out, like it would come out of the actual furnace where they were burning the person. And he goes, into this day, I can't eat fast food because all that I could smell was French fries burning off this person's body.
This is a critique of the culture on some level, right?
Completely. Yeah. I mean, I think that it's a critique on the culture and the choices we make. But at the same time, there's choices we make that that don't affect us. So who am I to tell you not to make the choices you make? Ultimately, at the end of the day, it's your life. You can do whatever you want. I, on the other hand, will choose to make a different choice, right, as will other people who I think watch the show will say, I'm not going to make that choice.
Is there a best sin now that you've experienced them all?
They're all pretty good. I don't know. It's hard to pick one. I you know, it's like I am a fan of gluttony. It's just it's in our blood. You know, it's who doesn't like to have, you know, a little bit more, a little bit extra too.
Well, you can say that, but you're looking pretty slim and trim these days.
I'm feeling slim. I am slim and trim these days. So now I'm just going to focus on lust, I guess. I'll let that one be my favorite now.
Back to lust. Morgan Spurlock, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Morgan Spurlock, director, filmmaker. His new series, Seven Deadly Sins, debuts on Showtime today. Confess your sins at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.